This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any book from my comic collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents, or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 38th episode of the Quarterbin Podcast, I'm looking at Shadow, Song of the Dragon, from DC Comics, cover date of January 1992. But first, a little feedback. There were a few stray comments on episode 35, the firearm issue. Sean Corey reported that he was downloading and listening to it, and Noel Thingvall tried his own Google foo to find the firearm VHS video. Wow, this really is ridiculously unavailable online, especially given how cheaply the actual VHS is listed on Amazon. Wonder if there's some legal department somewhere keeping it off the internet, which does happen from time to time. I think Noel nailed it there. That seems to be the prevailing theory on why it's so hard to find that thing digitally. On a related note, the Ultraverse Podcast Network is up and going. Hosts for that show include friends of Relatively Geeky, the Irredeemable Shag, Ben Avery, and David Gutierrez. There are other hosts and shows on the network as well, and they're really off to a good start. I love the idea of having one website, you know, one iTunes feed, one RSS, containing multiple different shows on it. I wonder where they got that idea from. Well, anyway, speaking of Shag, the man responsible for the book chosen in episode 35 did write in about that episode. I had a blast meeting you and Emily and appreciated the opportunity to dictate the topic of an episode. Firearm number one was a breath of fresh air back in 1993. Also, James Robinson was really laying the groundwork for what he'd do over in Starman a short time later. For example, you can see Firearm's love for his town of Pasadena as the genesis of Starman's love for his town of Opal City. Well, that's interesting. Again, good choice, Shag. There were also some comments on episode 36, the new 52 issue of Constantine. Jason Trenner emailed in about that issue, calling Constantine the character that DC seems to want to be the poster boy of the DCNU. He does say that he supports DC bringing in the Vertigo characters into the new 52 and using them in their main universe. Any real distinction between the mainstream DC universe and the grittier Vertigo line has also gone the way of the dinosaur. It does seem that way, Jason. It does definitely seem that way. He also reports that the next issue of Constantine has him briefly steal Captain Marvel's powers. Captain Marvel. I think Jason means Shazam, right? He's called Shazam. No, in his email, Jason very specifically said, "I'm calling him Captain Marvel, not Shazam." So I'm just poking back at him. Jason then opines on my finding that book in the 25-cent box. Surprised this book was in the quarter bin and not Grifter as well. It isn't a slam on the book as I enjoyed it, but when Rob Liefeld is the co-writer of the second run of the book, you'd think it goes straight to the cheat bins after that book is canned. Jason then lives into his fanboyumous prime nickname and spends many paragraphs talking about Dinobots, Michael Bay, ex-CIA guys, and Dan DiDio. I was very confused. But I think I can speak for Trennis Magnus when I say that emails from Jason are always an adventure to read. Daniel Butcher wrote in, maybe for the first time. He is from the Comic Book Time Machine and Welcome to Level 7 podcasts, where he's basically Ben Avery's handler, I guess we'd say. I don't know for sure that there's a court-mandated thing going on there, but, well, maybe I've said too much. Daniel reports that right when this episode dropped, he had Constantine, Volume 2, Blight, featuring issues 7 through 12 in his book bag. so you totally spoiled issue 8 for me by about 2 hours. Well, you know, Daniel, I did say that the book was only 8 months old. I didn't think I'd need to yell spoilers as well. I kind of thought it was implied. Daniel then explains how he got that trade in terms I can understand. I checked this book out from the library, Professor, so I got a 100% savings. I would say it cost me the walk to the library, but I actually picked up some things I like, such as the final 3 volumes of Scalped, so there was not even an opportunity cost for me. Now let me say this to everybody, I do recommend your local library as a source for trades. Some of the local branches around here have huge and varied selections. But I do think that would be cheating for me in terms of the podcast. A book has to be in my collection, or I have to have seen it with my own eyes on sale for 25 cents for it to count. But I have read nearly 200 issues of the New 52 via trades from local libraries. Daniel did point out one of the problems he has with DC's collections policy. Sometimes, like with Aquaman's Throne of Atlantis, they give you all the issues from an arc, including those outside the title. But often they give you only the specific issues from the specific title, while also producing another version that presents the whole story arc. So this trade of Constantine gave me only 50% of a story. I assume that if I had the Justice League Dark version of this trade, I'd get the other half. Or I guess I could buy Justice League Blight and get the full combined arc. You know, I did notice that some of the crossover stories that I've read have been, as Daniel says, but not all. I remember that both the Suicide Squad and Resurrection Man trades had both of the crossover issues in them. And I think there have been a few others too like that. But with this one, it was kind of a bummer that you'd have to get a whole other collection just to get the rest of the story. Back to the Irredeemable Shag, as he wrote in about this issue as well. I continue to enjoy your format, and you still manage to be marginally entertaining. Thanks, man. Yeah, it takes one to know one. I mean, I'm rubber and you're glue. Well, what Shag did go on to say was that he loved the Halloween background noise on the episode. Such fun. And then talked about how on Halloween night, he and his family blast a similar album across the front yard to create ambiance. And then they line their street with luminary bags, guiding, as he said, the hapless children to our lair. Finally, we give away mini comic books along with the candy. Yes, we're the kind of house kids will remember when they grow up, hopefully in a good way. You know, I have heard of people giving away those mini comic books, but I never think about it myself until early November, so... Shag continues, I enjoyed your coverage of Constantine. It sounded worth 25 cents, but was it worth $2.99? I'm not so sure. He then talks about his reading of Hellblazer during the Garth Ennis and Jamie Delano runs. I also follow Justice League Dark for the first couple years. Overall, I like the character of John Constantine. However, I feel in some ways his history and story have become overburdened, like other mainstream characters like Spider-Man. Now here, I have to say, Shag is starting to make sense. Think about it. If he started with Hellblazer 1 and read straight forward to the end, John's life has taken so many twists and turns that it doesn't really make sense for it to have happened to one person. Some hardcore Hellblazer fans may argue with me, but that's my feeling on the character. I enjoyed him for the first few years I followed him, but his life is so depressing, I can't see collecting it for 20 years without needing prescription meds to offset that depression. You know, I think this puts me in a distinct minority, but I don't mind reboots or resetting of continuity when it gets too cluttered. And I think Shag's onto something here, because, you know, these are fictional characters who have to have adventures at least once a month for our entertainment. Some characters 2, 3, or 4 times a month. And those life stories can become too confining at times, too burdensome. And look, sometimes a clean sweep is in order. That's sometimes the best answer, I think. On a related note, Emily and I are planning to talk about the comic book TV shows, including Constantine, on an upcoming Short Box Showcase probably around Christmas or early in the new year. Stay tuned. All right, as always, thanks for all the feedback, guys. It really does mean a ton to me. Let me take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll move on to our issue for this episode.
The Waves of Tech is the down-to-earth tech podcast for you, your family, and your friends. We remove all the complicated, drawn-out explanations of technology and simply talk about how technology is influencing every element of our lives. From social media and the cloud to tweeting and mobile communication, we talk tech in a different way. So plug in your devices and listen as we get ready to ride the Waves of Tech.
Whether it's technology, sports, educational, cultural, hobbies, or history, Netcast Studio has it all at netcaststudio.com.
Shadow, Song of the Dragon, Book 1, has the highest cover price of any book we've ever looked at here on the Quarterbin. Remember that Adam Strange prestige format series we covered back in episodes 15, 18, and 21? Those had a cover price of $3.95 each. Well, this prestige format series came out a few years later at a cover price of $4.95, meaning I acquired this comic at nearly a 95% off price tag. The cover by Michael David Lawrence shows a woman in profile set against a stone wall in a dark forest. She's holding a longbow and has a huge dragon tattoo on her left arm. A few things to note about the cover, actually about the woman. She does have a bare left arm, but is otherwise fully covered. And I don't know that we ever learn Shadow's actual age in the story, but she falls somewhere in the middle age category, I would say. Now, the inside of the book does earn its mature rating, but the lead character is a strong, impressive, independent female for sure. But she's not the stereotypical comic book hottie. And that works for me. The story, Souvenirs, was written by Mike Grell, who created the character of Shadow, with art by Michael Davis Lawrence and Gray Morrow. The issue itself starts with a series of flashbacks of a boy growing up in post-World War II America. Then I grew up and found my own war. Somehow it wasn't quite what I expected. Just at the time that I was old enough to understand, Dad stopped talking about the war and how he got the sword. The sword in question was taken as a souvenir by the father from a dead Japanese officer. Haunted by guilt, the son, now an older man himself, decides to return his father's sword to its rightful owners in Japan. This man, Mr. Ryan, flies to an antique shop in Hawaii, which seems like the best place to start his search for the sword's original owner. The shop owner immediately recognizes that the sword is something special. It bears the chrysanthemum symbol of the imperial house and is the work of the great master Masamune. It is the equivalent of a Stradivarius violin, the shop owner says, saying that the sword is reported to be able to cut through two men with a single slice. As a matter of fact, the sword is so great, it bears a name, an honor reserved for only the greatest, most legendary of blades. The name of this special blade translates into English as Kills the Dragon. The owner of the antique store, by the way, is Shadow, former lover of Oliver Queen Green Arrow, and the mother of his son, now maybe 6 years old or so. The entire time frame of this story is a bit, shall we say, hazy. After a bit of research, Shadow learns that Kills the Dragon is a Yakuza blade. Since she herself is former Yakuza, to the extent that anyone can really be former Yakuza, the blade's very presence puts her in peril. She briefly explains to the vet the history of Japan and the Yakuza, and we learn that the sword, for all intents and purposes, is a death warrant for Yakuza leadership, the Godfathers, if you will. The sword is an imperial sanction for murder. Ryan thanks Shadow for this education, and Japan is his next stop. But he won't be going alone. There are few who could help you, Shadow tells him. I am one who can. Whatever fate brought you here, it cannot be denied. I have an obligation. We call it giri. It is what must be done. While she tells the story, we learn that word of a special sword has reached certain interested ears in Tokyo. Shadow accompanies Mr. Ryan to Japan to solve the dilemma of the sword's presence. But the Yakuza has many eyes, and word of the sword's existence precedes them. Shadow traces the sword to the slain World War II officer and discovers that the Japanese man had two sons. One of the sons has become Oyaban, leader of the Yakuza, in the past few years. This happened when his master was slain by an arrow about 3 years ago in Green Arrow number 9. Shadow assumes that her karma has caught up with her. In the hands of a Yakuza leader, the sword would do great harm. But there is another brother, an elder, and thus the rightful heir. That brother is a monk, which may complicate things a bit, seeing as he's now a man of peace and has forsworn all earthly possessions. The pair travel to a Shingon ministry to find that older brother, the monk. There, Shadow finds another vet, an African-American gentleman, seeking respite at the monastery for his troubled mind, penance from sins of his past. After having a long conversation with the head monk, where he explains his purpose in coming and his desire for peace, Mr. Ryan and the elder son have an emotional meeting, and the sword is passed from the U.S. veteran to the Japanese monk. The end. From here, the next 3 1/4 issues of the series, the next 160 pages or so, are totally dedicated to a single Mahjong game on the flight back to Hawaii. Psych! That should be the ending. But of course, it isn't. Because a few pages before, the book earned its mature reader's designation, with a scene at a huge indoor bathhouse where we learn that the younger brother is the kind of rich, powerful douchebag to just have naked women hanging around his penthouse swimming pool / bathhouse. While he is having a soak, surrounded by lovely ladies, an assistant lets him know that Shadow and Mr. Ryan have the sword and appear to be heading to the monastery. Pray that you are right, the Yakuza leader says, for what I am about to do is a terrible thing, but nothing compared to the price of making a mistake. The assistant asks about how this will impact the alliance they're negotiating with the other crime families. The other families mean nothing. The alliance is merely financial expediency for the sole purpose of turning drugs into gold. But the sword is power, the fulfillment of a dream. This sword is destiny. So yeah, he's not just gonna let his big brother, the peaceful monk, have the mystical sort of power. A Yakuza squad attacks the monastery. Shadow and Mr. Ryan do defeat them. The sword and her skill with the longbow were enough to counter the attackers. But now they know there will be no rest until the conflict is settled. The younger brother will simply send more men next time. Better men. Better armed men. Mr. Ryan is horrified, shocked. This wasn't supposed to happen. This was supposed to be the end. But they all realize that the closure Mr. Ryan was seeking did not come. And now old wounds, and a few new ones, have opened for all of them. The older brother tells Ryan that his part in the affair is over, but Ryan disagrees. This has always been my fight. Besides, Shadow taught me a new word. Giri. Honor. The older brother, Shadow, and Mr. Ryan begin to depart. What about him? Shadow asks, pointing to the other veteran, the black man. The man who has said nothing during the issue, not a single word, and spent the entirety of the preceding battle on his knees, scrubbing the monastery floor, performing his penance? Leave him, he's useless, Ryan says. But Shadow disagrees. She reaches a hand out to the man, still on his knees, and he accepts it. And so our foursome, our fellowship, the old vet, the silent vet, Shadow, and the monk, head off to face their destiny.
Join us in a journey of a reluctant hero who explores the psyche of a dragon, the depths of a dwarvish mind, and the mysteries of his own heart in order to find the true meaning of love, loyalty, and happiness.
I'm looking for someone to share in an adventure.
Listen to The Secrets of the Hobbit on SQPN.com.
Oh, we like goblins as bats and fishes, but we haven't tried hobbits before.
And we're back. First, let me explain the rules for how I read and am reviewing this series. In order to determine whether I wanted to cover the entire series on the podcast, I did read the whole thing. I didn't want to spend four episodes covering this if it wasn't as good as I was hoping. Sure, I've covered books that weren't so good here. I'm looking at you, Nick Fury's Howling Commandos. Stormwatch Team Achilles. Sorry, Shag. Firearm. But I didn't want to subject you to a four-episode run of not so good. So I read the whole thing just to make sure. But to keep these episodes honest, if you will, I made notes after reading each one. So there are references to my hopes or my thoughts or predictions of what will happen in future issues. That's just to try to capture what I was really feeling at the moment. So there is a bit of awkward wibbly-wobbliness as I'm asking questions that I actually do know the answers to now, as I record this, but, you know, I didn't know those answers as I read the issues, if that makes sense. So, anyway, on to the book. Mike Grell came to Green Arrow in 1987 with the three-issue Longbow Hunters series. In the first issue, we meet a great new supporting character in the mysterious Japanese archer Shadow. In the course of Grell's run on the Green Arrow monthly title, which spun out of the success of Longbow Hunters, Shadow once took advantage of Green Arrow's injuries and delirium to seduce the Emerald Archer. Ollie was hallucinating at the time and believed that he was with his longtime lover, Black Canary. At least that's his side of the story. That encounter left Shadow with a son, who does appear with her in the issue in a few panels at the antique store in Hawaii. Now, I was confused at first whether Mr. Ryan, the soldier with the sword, knew of Shadow, went specifically to her antique store for a reason, or if his trip to her antique store was just fortuitous, or in Shadow's terms, her karma catching up with her. I'm inclined to think it was the latter, though Grell does not answer every question asked. Some of those details were left to our own senses to divine. Grell does a really good job characterizing both of the leads here, Shadow and Mr. Ryan. And with Mr. Ryan, he's doing it from scratch. Now, we're likely to bring some history or knowledge of Shadow to the story as readers, whether from Longbow Hunters or from the Green Arrow story or just other DC stories, heck, even the Arrow TV show. But not so much for Mr. Ryan. He is a blank slate. But through a combination of narratives and images, a mix of third-person and first-person perspectives, and the art that helps tell the story, we get a really good feel for him. You know, by the time we're done, we have a bit of a handle on both of the brothers as well, the monk and the gangster, and even the silent veteran. He's pretty much an unknown at this point, but we do sense a little bit about him. So we do know enough about the key players here at the end of issue one, a quarter of the way through the series, to have some level of investment in them. As I mentioned in the first section of the episode, the time frame is unclear. Ryan could be a Korea vet or a Vietnam vet, but I can be flexible about that. It's actually never stated which. The only date that matters, that has to be locked into place, locked into history, is the father getting the sword during World War II. My hunch is that that's the story that Grell wanted to tell and didn't want to get too bogged down in all of the details of time and place that would make that story more difficult to tell. Now, this first book in the series is paced more like a novel than a comic book, which makes for an odd or at least a different type of reading experience. Given that extra room, the extra breathing space that a 48-page book allows, Grell lets the pace move a bit slower than a 22-page shoot-em-up. The book also has the feel of a manga in places, of which I've only read a few. But perhaps given the subject nature or the setting, Grell sort of wanted to go in that direction. This book has 14 totally silent pages. And that's the type of thing I've only run across in Lone Wolf and Cub. Now, most of those totally silent pages have multiple panels, so it's not just like one silent splash page. You know, it's a page that may have 4 or 6 or 8 panels, but are totally silent. It's the art itself that's doing the storytelling on those pages, and doing it pretty well. The art does a real good job of setting the mood for the story. There are a lot of flashbacks, especially to Mr. Ryan's time in the service. And in these, there's always a bit of the abstract art going on. My understanding is that Grell is actually a little disappointed about how those scenes turned out. He intended an even more distinct change of an art style or color palette for the flashbacks than what happens in the final version. But I don't think that hinders the book. You know, I wonder if that's just the curse of a writer-artist like Mike Grell, having to turn over the art chores to someone else. Maybe there's a bit of micromanaging there, or I wish I'd had the time to do this all myself. Now, back to the pacing of the book. Again, to me it more resembles a novel than a comic, because I have to admit that not a lot happens in the first 40 or so of these pages. At least, not a lot of comic booky things happen. There's not an action scene until something like page 40, when the Yakuza end up at the monastery. Up until that point, we have a nice character story going, with really just the occasional ominous foreshadowing from the Yakuza side of the plot. But as is clear here, and becomes more clear as the story progresses, Song of the Dragon is not a superhero story. Shadow, although nearly as skilled, maybe more so, as Green Arrow, she's not pursuing the life of a costumed vigilante, and therefore this story is not the same story as that of a costumed vigilante. You know, this is just a story that allows Shadow to step out of her supporting role and stand alone as a main character, and I think he does a really good job of giving us a reason for this to be a Shadow story. The type of story that it makes sense for this character to be involved in at this stage of her life and career. Again, that pacing is still odd for a comic. As I said, emotion and character trumps action and adventure. I love how this one American vet's search for redemption has led to a battle between Japanese brothers. And I imagine that the peaceful brother, the monk, will win in some way. But I have no idea how, and I have no idea what that's going to end up looking like, what his quote-unquote victory, if it does happen, will accomplish. I just don't think the sword will end up in the Yakuza's hands. It'll be destroyed or hidden in another monastery, something like that. That's my guess, after reading just the first issue. I mentioned the mature readers label on this book. Actually, this issue is the only one in the series that fails to contain that notation, but it was intended to. The lack of that label is clearly just an error. All of the other issues say mature readers only, and there is content that requires that designation here. There are naked ladies in that pool scene, and a topless Shadow right at the end, as she has dropped her kimono off her shoulders to enable her boat work in the battle at the monastery. I don't know what age she's supposed to be in the timeline of Green Arrow and the age of the child, but she appears to be well into her 30s, maybe beyond that. So again, none of this nudity is intended to be particularly erotic. It's there to be natural, I think. And Mr. Ryan may be in his 50s as well, as having protagonists in that age range, you know, works for me, especially at my age. Again, neither the nude scenes were particularly erotic. They seem to be in there only to earn the mature reader's label, since there's no other objectionable language and no gory blood spurting. There were opportunities for that, with the World War II memories or the Yakuza discussion, and certainly the battle at the monastery, but none of those were particularly bloody or gruesome. So even though Grell is doing a mature story, he didn't take it down those typical paths. It's actually the content of the story that is the real mature reading here. Mature in the actual sense of that word. There's a complexity in the story, a depth of emotion that is beyond the usual four-color adventures that comic companies were offering at the time. Remember, this is 1992 when this is published. The silent panels, the jumps in time, all demand attention of the reader. Now, I do hope the narrative becomes a little easier to follow as the issues go by. I was, every now and then, confused by the cast of characters, too. There are named characters that we don't see much of, and many of those are Japanese names that I confess got a little mixed up in my little American brain. And then we have major characters that are barely named. Mr. Ryan's name is, I believe, mentioned once, as is the monk's name, the elder brother. The silent vet, the African-American guy, he's never mentioned by name in this issue. So there's a confusion there where we have lots of names of characters who I don't think are important, and lots of unnamed characters who are important. And that's just kind of odd. So there were definite hurdles that Mike Grell put in the way of readers enjoying this book. Again, it had much more in common with the way novels that I read develop than comics that I read. That's, again, in terms of pacing, the cast of characters, their motivations, things like that. The verdict on Shadow Song of the Dragon Book 1, Mike Grell could write the first 48 pages of the Albuquerque phone book, and it would be well worth 25 cents to me. Throw in an exotic foreign setting, a lady of mystery, and brother versus brother conflict in a square-bound format that still looks good 2+ decades later. Did I mention there were no ads? This is a no-brainer. Of course it's worth 25 cents. It's an official quarter-bin steal. But I recognize that this won't be for everybody, even less so than the Adam Strange series. It moves slowly. It vaguely resembles a manga. It does not contain a superhero, and is about emotional stakes way more than it is about battles and fights and regular comic book fare. In other words, don't blame me if you find this somewhere for a couple of bucks. Buy it and don't dig it. That wraps up my coverage of Shadow, Song of the Dragon Book 1, bringing episode 38 of the Quarterbin podcast to a close. And yes, we will knock out all the remaining issues of this series before we get to the epic, epic episode 50. In episode 39, we'll be looking at our last book to celebrate Batman's 75th birthday year. It's a story from 1964, but it's in a comic that was published in 1992. Confused yet? Wondering what it could be? Well, it could be Silver Age Classics Detective Comics 327. Or it could be, well, that is what it is. That's what we're looking at next episode. Silver Age Classics Detective Comics 327. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the podcast, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarterbin podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.